I'm Christopher Lydon in our poetry series, Whose Words These Are. Asking again, who's writing poetry in this day and age, in this neighborhood, in the great tradition, or in their own tradition? What if it's the guy next door? What if it's a first-generation American from Worcester, Massachusetts, named Alex Charalambides? This is Open Source from the Watson Institute at Brown University, an American conversation with global attitude, we call it. Alex Charalambides, introduce yourself, please, with a poem. I put you somewhere between slam poetry and the written word, but speak for yourself.
Phoenix is a charming two-year-old singing in the corner while her mother fixes dinner. Me, I'm just the visitor, a tourist with questionable talent, pondering the viability of making a living off of my poetry while snacking on their hospitality in Duluth, Minnesota, October 2005. Having finished the fall recital, a spirited medley consisting of classic preschool standards like Itsy Bitsy Spider, she begins a free-form jam riffing off the phrase, look at me, look at me, look at me. Melody shift sends shivers through my day. Yo, that's what all art says, I say. Then laugh, uncomfortably, the way only adults can. Look at me, look at me. There's no insistence in her song, only a benevolent invitation. And man, if my biological clock didn't stop right there and jump rope skip a bit. So yeah, I guess I do kind of want your attention. All artists who dare take page or stage, we just tend to augment like, look at me, war is fundamentally wrong. Look at me, the world's in desperate need of new love songs. Look at me, I saw an elderly woman eating alone at a Taco Bell once, and it made me want to cry. Look at me, crazy. Look at me, hey, I graduated from ugly. Look at me, I dig jazz. The good kind. Look at me, I dig trenches. I'm not sure if they're the good kind, but the money helps put my baby through university. Look at me, why do so few have that opportunity? When an 18-year-old's options run basically A, join the military, B, spend time in a penitentiary, or C, indentured servitude for a corporate monopoly, I say look at me, because I am frantically searching for option D. Look at me, your references are valid, poet, but I'd rather build a new mythology. Look at me, because I think I know some words that you don't know. So why does my message still feel empty? Look at me, I like this president, but let's still impeach the Electoral College. Look at me, fantasy? Alex is a construct that exists brilliantly to replace the beauty missing in reality. Look at me, community. Look at me, I remember that day at the zoo when I saw I was living in a cage too. Look at me in the ways I flunked out of being with you. Look at me, the rapture of our collective song. Look at me, the precise socioeconomic reasons why we all can't just get along. Look at me, I'm funny when I drink. Look at me, sobriety's worth it. Look at me, this stinks. I just wrote it. Don't know what to make of it. Maybe you can find something worth salvaging. Look at me in my lovely, lovely flow. Look at me, I got two tickets to anywhere. What would you like to know? Look at me, this writer, painter, singer, brother, lover, mother, and or other never got their proper due. Look at me for the ones who saved my life. Look at me in my selfish use of this device. Look at me, cliche, cliche, cliche. Hey, how will this original thought get in there? Cliche. Look at me, poetry, creating tomorrow's cliches today. Look at me, because this is what spoken word is. Look at me, I believe in it like God, like I love it so much. I never dared define what either of them are. Look at me, perfect snapshots, black and white. Look at me, the light at the tunnels, not quite what they think it is. Look at me, for these few moments, I give you all express verbal permission to be all up in my business. Look at me, sometimes it's the words you leave out. Look at me, art. Art is a force we all know something about. Look at me, because I saw some of the best minds of my generation destroyed by the sadness of not possessing the madness to follow through. Look at me and this prayer I was blessed enough to receive from an angel. She was only two.
I'm looking at you, Alex Charalambides. I believe you believe in it.
I see you looking at me.
But what is it?
I would label it some sort of self-actualization where for 3 minutes, 4 minutes, 5 minutes, however long I'm performing, I'm becoming the person I've always dreamt of being. Kind of creating this reality for myself. And in a way, a lot of the poems I write are sort of markers for me to try to live up to as a person. Lessons that I've either figured out through a life experience or some kind of self-motivational tool I use to kind of try to be the person I want to be.
How long has this been going on? How did it happen? Who told you you could? Who made you do it? What was the poem that said, I could do that?
The poem, and I share this story with a lot of performance poets and slam poets. I started writing in college. Originally, I wanted to be, you know, in a rock and roll band and sing, but I'm not much of a singer. I loved movies, independent films, and theater, and I wrote some plays and screenplays, but tried to make them myself and couldn't really get that off the ground, either for not being able to find money or people to work with. But while I was trying to become a budding filmmaker, I was watching every independent film I could get my hands on for inspiration and just ideas. And a friend of mine told me about this very small budget independent film called Slam. It stars a poet named Saul Williams. It's a story about a poet who sells drugs and gets thrown in jail and finds his true poetic voice behind bars and comes to all these revelations for himself. And I watched this film. I couldn't believe that I'd never seen someone perform poetry with no music, no elaborate staging. It was just a person in a microphone. And that day I was like, wow, I want to do that. Or I think I can do that. Or there's got to be some place around here where I can go see this live. And within a month or two, I took some old song lyrics to an open mic. And within a year, I was at a national poetry slam tournament, you know, representing the city of Worcester, and you know, the rest is history for me. Hooked.
It's exciting. Now that we're looking at you, give us another taste, or maybe another sure. tonality.
Sure. Based off a true story. A couple years ago, I had one of those days where working, earning a minimum wage living by the sweat of these bushy little brows, actually made sense. It was a manly day, lifting and relifting heavy boxes, breathing air efficiently, humming a happy tune, all the while feeling proud of my general usefulness. For lunch that day, bacon double cheeseburger, extra large fry and a Coke, and it tasted so good, felt like it belonged in my body. Later that evening, I performed, and I don't mind telling you, I let it all out, afterwards feeling peaceful, while enjoying an extra large slice of greasy pepperoni pizza, chewed with purpose, not merely to pass the time, but an intrinsically meaningful meal that fed my life, and not just my hunger. And friends, what I'm trying to say here, if there's a point or moral to be found anywhere in this story, it's that I used to eat a lot of crap. Sweet land of gluttony of the eye. Once ordered a hamburger in Transylvania. If you don't believe me, then du te moașta. Eu vorbesc românește foarte bine, mulțumesc. Yes, I'm a first-generation American. My parents are first-generation Romanian. My grandparents, for the record, they were Greek. But if you ask me, ethnicity these days only lasts about a generation deep, right? But, oh yeah, the hamburger. I was 9 years old. Family vacation to the foster motherland. Harshly ripped from America's affluent womb. Entombed in a rented minibus. Complete with a paid chauffeur. And a personal tour guide who was really digging this new Beatles rock and roll craze in 1984. In 1984, your American dollar went far on the Eastern Bloc. Waiters, cab drivers, bellhops, and shopkeepers of all persuasions welcomed us like royalty. We made our way to Transylvania. I was excited, and my parents were proud to return to the land of their birth. But for a child of nine, food had been a bit of an issue. Oh, they tried to warn me. No BK, no Mickey D's, no hot dog stands in the capital of Bucharest. Their sodas were merely uncarbonated bottles of colored water. In a couple weeks of traveling and goulash started pushing this nine-year-old to the brink, that is, until I saw the menu at the Hotel Dracula. On it read hamburger. Simple, joyful tears swept down my face. It had all come down to this, a Transylvanian hamburger. Extra bloody. Now, deceased novelist William Faulkner once wrote that memory forgets before knowing remembers. What I distinctly recalled from that day was the absolute Hollywood rock star fit I threw when my plate arrived. On it, a piece of toast, topped with a slab of burnt ham, covered with a fried egg, peppered with some oozingly morbid type of goat cheese, no French fries, no Coca-Cola, no ketchup. It took a couple of days for my anger to morph into this cosmically immature form of pity wherein I genuinely felt sorry for a people, for a culture that couldn't understand, dared not grasp the simple concept that was a hamburger, spoiled the trip. I yawned at family reunions. I paid little to no attention to the beautiful countryside. I stared incredulously at this overjoyed peasant farm family whom we visited on a whim, commandeering our rented minivan off a thin, winding highway so my parents could barter barrettes and bubblegum for a cup of fresh, unpasteurized milk from their cow. Mom and Dad were thrilled with the novelty. I refused the sip offered to me. Seems like a lot of things were beneath me then. Sure, I was 9 all day long, but this land of the free has a way of instilling supremacy into its young. I was an American brat. Cancel that. I am a spoiled American brat. I am racking my brain, trying to find the Romanian translation for I'm sorry. I can't find it. I'm sorry. I live in a land where too many people feel they never have to say those words.
Alex, I'm listening and wondering, what's this conversation about? What's this community of slam poets? Who's in it? Who's out of it? What are we saying to each other?
I think the slam poetry community is special because everybody's in it. Everybody that wants to be in it and bring their energy to it. What I love about it is the diversity of voice and style and background that so many times I'm really overwhelmed by the friends I've made in this scene, you know, across every single normal societal divide. Like we're coming together and networking and connecting and listening to each other's stories. And so many times I'll talk to somebody, I'll be like, do you realize like you and I would never know each other? We would never know each other in any sort of circumstance, except for the fact that we both do this strange thing that seems to not have a lot of value in the general societal parameters, but we have a fire for it.
And what's the assumption about a connection with the longer tradition, either of storytelling or poetry or performance or what?
The longer tradition of poetry, Whitman kind of dreamed about this large, amazing audience for poetry one day. One day, he kind of spoke of this vision. And I think we are trying to make poetry alive for ourselves, and by making alive for ourselves, I think we are inspiring a whole generation of people to find the value and for poetry not to just live on a bookshelf, but in our everyday lives.
I read an interesting line from the poet Carl Dennis about Walt Whitman and his America. He said it wasn't a nation of laws or government. It was a community of expressive people sort of spinning out their fantasies to each other, making themselves in each other's mind, as bloggers, I think, begin to think of themselves as doing.
I think there's this democratization in slam poetry where, you know, our whole shtick is giving score paddles to 5 strangers who could be qualified to judge poetry or not qualified to judge, and that makes them qualified. Someone's opinion of a poem is no longer... it's no longer assigned to somebody. Nobody takes ownership of being the expert on what is good poetry and what is not. We've randomly taken that out of the equation and given it to 5 people who may know nothing about poetry, may not even care, may not be listening, you know. Yet we kind of acclimate ourselves to this idea that there is no grand authority on what is important to say and who's got the right to say it. It's kind of a populist movement.
Including the poetry you write for the page, Alex, who are you talking to?
I think it changes. Sometimes I think I write something just for me. Sometimes I might be writing with the idea. I have a poem about reaching out to the great love that I haven't even met yet, trying to explain my history of unrequited love and things like that. So that was a specific sort of idea I had that I was just writing to one. But I think a lot of people listened to it and sort of connected to it.
You want to recite it?
Maybe
she's listening.
I sure could, right? I wasted years finger flipping through a periodic table of sentimental episodes, insatiably searching for semi-salacious syllables that will most adequately represent my vision of you. You're so... gosh, how do I say this? You are so cute. Can you believe that's all I've come up with so far? Man, I must have gotten the wrong prescription. Properly medicated individuals do not run into quite so much trouble when posed with such simple, soulful questions. I wasted years gagging on a sweet tart named Desire, took it out of the package too soon, tricked my subconscious with phony expiration dates and insincere hunger pangs, but it's only because I really wanted to share. But you know, sometimes life bears down too hard, wears your patience like a corsage to that perfect prom that only exists when you're on the outside, looking in, and so it was with me. Peeking through windows, watching happy couples partake in rightful passage rituals, getting on with that business of life, and I recognize and admit my own penchant for weakness, wallowing away because, hey, I must have enjoyed the yearning. It made me feel special. But I gotta tell you, I just do not have the time to devote to unrequited love like I used to. It's like I used to just lie in dark places, rocking out to sorrow's profound music, taking solace in the conviction that suffering guaranteed some form of reward. And I waited. I just waited for that reward. I fantasized that there'd be enhanced mood lighting when that special moment arrived. I foolishly followed up on such outlandish sensibilities, freely visiting nightclubs in the hopes that she might see me in that light, fight her way through a crowd of our peers, and make the discovery for both of us. Sounds pretty stupid. I know, fly fishing, using desperation for bait, rocking back and forth, frothing at the mouth with beer-soaked breath and bitter doubts, cajoling love to just jump on my hook because I felt that I deserved it in some arcane promised land sort of way. Nowadays, I try to stay put. More often than not physically, so to speak, because I'm always moving. It's just that I've recently purchased some books that I've been neglecting for far too long, rejecting the lovelorn philosophies of others on principle. But maybe one day, if I can gather up enough of those principles, well, maybe one day I can start building until I actually have something to stand on. From there, perhaps you'll see me. From there, I pray I'll be in a position to see you, and until then, you can remain an invention. Patent pending, lending your smile whenever I stop to think or reflect, living, laughing, and loving in yesterday's dreams and today's bountiful promise.
Thank you. Seems to me that performance poets have seized the initiative in the Massachusetts Poetry Festival. How do they feel up on the stage with the Mark Doty's of the world?
I think any performance poet worth their salt should embrace that so much. There are a lot of performance poets and slam poets who almost disregard the whole literary tradition just because they think they're on the new wave of doing things the way they ought to be done. But they don't even bother to try to connect with everyone else. They're just happy being in their performance space. But I think a good performance poet should try to reach anybody. I'm very much a believer in not trying to be a big fish in a small pond. I want to expand the pond. I want a huge pond. I want poetry slams happening all the time, everywhere, or poetry readings happening.
You teach, Alex. What are students learning from you, and what do you learn from them?
I've been coaching youth poets for the past 7 years. I think students, first thing I want students to take away, especially given that sometimes I have a limited amount of time to connect with them, is that this is worthwhile. Expressing yourself and sharing with others is completely worthwhile, and try to show them that a lot of great things can come of it. That is my main focus, is to show people that expressing yourself and working on the craft of expressing yourself is one of the greatest gifts that you can use, not only for the sake of poetry or the sake of literature, but I mean just the sake of being a healthy, patient, loving human being.
What do you learn from them specifically about the times we're going through now? 2011. Rounding out the first 4 years of the age of Obama, a thoroughly tricky time in America. What do you suppose your work will be said someday to reflect about this moment in history?
I think things move so exponentially fast right now. It seems like every year brings a whole new level of innovation, and our young people are definite reflections of these fast-paced times. Like they're things like, I think, like ADD, or you know, are almost coping mechanisms for how fast things are moving, or their reflections on the exponential nature of how fast we move. So I think in a way we really need this next generation, maybe more than we're comfortable admitting, is that I don't know if we've given them the world they deserve. I think we are going to end up asking a lot from them. And I think they're going to, for the most part, a lot of them are going to possess this level of quick thinking genius that might be required in order to help us all out in our old age.
Come back to your place in the great chain of poetic being. What's the poem you aim at as a kind of perfection?
My favorite poem, I'd written some poems before I had read this poem, but this was the first poem that really kind of put into perspective what poetry was for me, is Lawrence Ferlinghetti's Constantly Risking Absurdity from his book Coney Island of the Mind. I love that piece because to me it really places this in the context of trying to perform and reach out and connect and say what's on your mind is, I guess, an absurd act, but still doesn't mean that it's not valid or worthwhile or the best thing you can possibly do. Yeah, I always think of that phrase. I do a pretty good cover, I think, a decent cover of the poem, because it's one of my favorites. So of course I've committed it to memory, but just the title itself is probably my favorite phrase.
Would you give us the poem?
Sure. Constantly risking absurdity and death whenever he performs above the heads of his audience, the poet, like acrobat, climbs on rhyme to a high wire of his own making. Above a sea of faces, paces his way to the other side of day, performing intricates and sleight of foot tricks and other high theatrics, all without mistaking anything for what it may not be. For he is the super realist who must perforce perceive taught truth before the taking of each stance or step in a supposed advance that still higher perch where beauty stands and waits to make her death-defying leap. And he, a little Charlie Chaplin man, who may or may not catch her fair eternal form spread-eagled in the empty air of existence.
Thank you, Lawrence. Thank you, Alex.
Thank you, Lawrence.
Can I ask you what we presume to call our Proust questionnaire, Alex?
Sure.
A few off-the-wall questions. If you weren't a poet, what would you be?
If I was not a poet, I would be a bass player.
What's the talent you'd most love to have but don't yet?
I would love to be organized, but I don't call that a talent. I would love to be a really great cook.
Who's your ideal artist in another medium? Who's doing the spiritual work of Alex Harlambides in another way?
The spiritual work of Alex Harlambides. Daniel Quinn is my favorite writer, not necessarily for the way he writes, but his overall message. I have it tattooed on my arm. He wrote this book called The Story of Bee, and anyone who kind of goes through this book and understands what he's saying about his feelings on the way things are, the way human beings have gotten to be like we are and where we are headed, turns you into this character named B if you've received this message and feel changed by it. So I've even tattooed on my arm, and I have an album that is called I Am B that's sort of dedicated to that. I love Tom Waits as a singer, songwriter, musician. I think he shows such a range of emotion and style and in texture of voice, even though they sound all scraggly. And I love his work. I'm not visually, I'm colorblind, so I don't know if I see a lot of visual art the way I would like to or the way others see it. So I definitely appreciate Matisse or Van Gogh, but I don't know if I see their world the way others do.
What's the quality above all that you look for in a good poem?
Honesty.
What would you say is the key note of your personality as a poet?
I try to make my poems say yes as much as I can.
What's your motto?
My motto: quit your job and get to work.
Thank you. Alex Haralambides, thank you so much for your work. Thank you for this conversation.
Thank you. Anytime.
Ben Mandelkern produced and edited this conversation with Alex Haralambides. At the Massachusetts Poetry Festival, you can hear Alex and all manner of other poets perform or just read. The festival runs Friday and Saturday, May 13th and 14th, in the city of Salem, north of Boston. See masspoetry.org for details. Special thanks to the Grolier Poetry Bookshop in Harvard Square for letting us make a studio of their store. Feedback, please, with a comment at our website, radioopensource.org. I'm Christopher Lydon. Thank you for being part of the conversation.